From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A stunning upset last night in Michigan. Bernie Sanders defeated Hillary Clinton. He did it by the narrowest of margins, taking 50% of the vote to her 48. It's a big momentum boost for Sanders, who had taken some heavy losses in the South and did again yesterday in Mississippi, where Clinton ruled. And of course, she's way ahead in the delegate count. A little later in this hour of On Point, we're going to look at big news in Europe's refugee crisis and Turkey's controversial role. But first today, we're going to the Sanders campaign and the top Sanders strategist, Tad Devine, the day after the big Sanders upset victory in Michigan. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What is the message out of Michigan for Democrats, Sanders supporters, Clinton supporters, beyond? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Miami in Florida is Tad Devine, top strategist to the Bernie Sanders campaign. Tad, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you. How did you do it in Michigan, sir?
Well, I think we fought really hard in Michigan. Bernie's message of taking on a rigged economy, an economy that sends almost all the new wealth to the top, and a rigged economy that's held in place by a corrupt system of campaign finance, I think resonated powerfully, as did his message on trade. I mean, Bernie Sanders has opposed, I think, every trade agreement that has come before the Congress. While he's been there for the last 25 years, he's seen them as vehicles to export American jobs overseas. And I think it was the opposition to trade and that central economic message that resonated powerfully in Michigan.
So it worked for you, but the polls said, and you know this very well, that Clinton was up by 20 points on the eve of this vote. You're quoted in Politico saying, you know, even a near win would be pretty good. An outright win would be unbelievable. So what happened? We've got the message, but give us the math. What worked out for you here?
Yeah. Well, we looked at our own polling, and while I thought the race was going to be close, and I was not predicting that we were going to win, I thought we could get it down to single digits. I think what happened was the last 48 hours, so last really three days, a number of things happened. Number one, I think Bernie Sanders had a very strong performance in the debate with Hillary Clinton. I think a lot of people saw that in the debate, and they said, oh, he was too aggressive, or he said things inappropriately to her, or something of that nature. I think quite to the contrary. He had a long and vigorous debate with her on the issue of trade and whether or not the trade policies, which she has supported in the past and he has opposed, were good for Michigan and America. And I think that really got through. I think he did a good job the next night. We had an opportunity with a town hall meeting on Fox News, which a lot of people saw as well. I think his campaigning across the state, I think if you look at Hillary's campaigning, a lot of it was concentrated in and around metropolitan Detroit. We campaigned all across the state of Michigan. Got a lot of people excited. I was with him at a rally in Ann Arbor the night before the elections, almost 6,000 people there, and they were very excited about him. So I think it was a combination of the tactics we employed and the message that he delivered, and particularly his performance in the debate.
Here was Sanders last night with the press late at night. A poll number showed a tight race between him and Hillary Clinton.
We were 60 or 70 points down in the polls, and yet what we have seen is in poll after poll, state after state, what we have done is created the kind of momentum that we need to win.
Bernie Sanders last night, and he took it by 2 points. Tad Devine is his top strategist. He is with us across the South. Bernie had taken some heavy lickings. He did again yesterday in Mississippi. Clinton crushed him there with 89 to 11% with black voters. What about the African-American vote in Michigan, Tad?
Well, we were very pleased to see in Michigan the exit polls that Bernie is now up over 30%. Support with African-American voters. And if you go down the age spectrum of that with younger African-American voters, he's actually going toe-to-toe with her and winning almost as much support as she does. So we understand that if Bernie's going to be the nominee of the party, we're going to have to win more support from African-American voters. You know, I think in these early contests concentrated in the South, voters there know Hillary Clinton well. She was the first lady of Arkansas for many years. That's a state that abuts many others in the South. They were comfortable with her and her record. But I think as we move through this process and voters, African-American voters, Latinos, other voters in this process get to know more about Bernie Sanders' record, I think with African-American voters in particular, his activism, civil rights movement, his record of support for issues they care about in Congress, and his agenda to empower people and to take on injustice in our society. I think it's going to resonate powerfully, and I think we'll continue to win more and more support.
Trade was big. It was huge. We talked about it right here yesterday, Tad. Of course, the other person on the trail who is talking very critically about U.S. trade deals is Donald Trump, and there's speculation in the press this morning that if it comes down to Clinton, Trump in the end, and I know that's not where you're aiming, but that Trump may actually take some of those, that same sentiment that's anti-free trade deal, and use it against Clinton if she's the Democratic flag bearer.
Well, I think that's a legitimate concern. Trump is very unorthodox in his positions on a broad range of issues. He does not conform to Republican orthodoxy on trade and other issues as well. And I think if he goes into states like Michigan, or even his home state of New York, and begins to deliver two things. Number one, an issue about economics, particularly centered on trade. And number two, and I think this is even a bigger threat if Hillary is the nominee of the party, if Trump goes in and says, listen, I am not beholden to special interests. I do not take their money. That is one of the reasons I think Bernie is succeeding. And I think that's why he, against Trump, would be a much better candidate. Hillary is going to really, I think, be vulnerable on those attacks on trade and also on the attacks of taking special interest money to fund her campaign.
We've got callers for you here from Sanders territory, Bridgewater, Vermont. Howard, you're on with the top strategist for the Bernie Sanders campaign, Tad Devine.
Thanks, Tom. Mm-hmm. You know, I really do think that Bernie has a way better chance than Hillary. And it's not about all of her political baggage, and it's not about her likability and her flip-flopping and all that, nor is it about her not disclosing those transcripts. What it's about is that she hasn't created the intensity, and more importantly, she's not getting the turnout that Trump is getting and that Bernie would get in the general election.
Howard, she's got the delegates stacked up like firewood already, though. What about it?
Yeah, well, Bernie and Hillary both stated that they need a strong Democratic turnout in the general election to win. And if Hillary beats Bernie in the primary, she's not going to get the votes that she needs by those who now support Bernie.
Howard, we've got it. Our time is short with Tad Devine. Tad, take us through this delegate count. I mean, two things. Bernie Sanders said last night the rest of the map, he thinks, looks favorable to him. So take us through that map and work with us on the delegate count, because she's got a lot more delegates stacked up than Bernie Sanders at this point. How do you make it work as Sanders' strategist?
Well, we're going to have to, well, first let me just say I agree with Howard. I think, he's absolutely right about the enthusiasm for the turnout, and that's the key to this election. You know, in terms of winning the delegates, she does have an enormous advantage. And on the Democratic side, we have a system of proportional representation that makes it hard to win delegates in large numbers. But we believe we can, and here's how. We're going to have a bunch of contests next week. In some big states, there's going to be a lot of delegates on the table. We're going to compete. I don't know if we're going to win. Most of those states are, many of them, but I do think we will win delegates in all of them and try to add to our total. Then we're going to start moving into territory where I think Bernie Sanders is going to do really well. Places like Washington State, places like Wisconsin. I think we can actually show down with Hillary Clinton in her own state of New York. Bernie is a guy who grew up in Brooklyn. He's got an incredible story to tell about his own life and experience there. He's someone who I think upstate New Yorkers know well from being close to Vermont and the Burlington media market, so we gained some advantage from that. I think his message is going to resonate powerfully in New York. And then we're going to go through a number of states like Pennsylvania, a lot of northeastern states, and then we're going to move on to places like California and New Jersey. You know, one of the advantages we have in this process in terms of catching up is in 2008, California, New Jersey, and New York were all on Super Tuesday. This year, they're very late in the process. New York's in mid-April. California and New Jersey are in June. So we've got time to catch up. And I think if we do catch up and we beat her in a lot of these states all across this nation, I think Democratic superdelegates and others are going to take a step back. They're going to look at Bernie versus Trump in the polls, and they're going to ask themselves a very serious question. This is the question we want them to ask. Who will be the strongest candidate to take on the Republican and win the general election? And I think when that happens, if we do what we need to do and catch up in delegates, I think Bernie will win the nomination.
Does a Sanders victory, Tad Devine, count on superdelegates who have leeway in how they cast their vote jumping ship, leaving the Clinton column of their own accord and going to Sanders? Do you have to woo them over?
Yes, we're going to have to win support. But remember in 2008, Barack Obama won support of over 120 superdelegates who previously had endorsed Hillary Clinton. They came to him during the course of the process before the convention. So there is precedent for large-scale superdelegate movement. And I think we can do it here. It's going to take some time. It's not going to be easy. I'm not suggesting that this is just going to fall into our lap. He's going to have to work hard and earn it. But I think if we do this right, those superdelegates will do the right thing and support Bernie if he proves he's the strongest candidate in this race.
So that means victory is not just on winning these primaries, but it's on persuading superdelegates that he would be the stronger candidate against the Republican, perhaps Donald Trump.
It is. You know, we're going to have to win that argument and not just win these primaries and caucuses coming up. And I think we can win the argument. Right now, our argument is bolstered by the polling. If you look at almost all of the polls that we've seen in recent weeks, there was a CNN poll out a week or so ago that reaffirmed this. Bernie is the strongest candidate against Trump and against Cruz, for example. I mean, Bernie was beating Ted Cruz by 17 points and Hillary Clinton was losing to Ted Cruz. So, I mean, I think if the polling in the weeks ahead looks that way, I think superdelegates in the Democratic Party are going to they want to win. They understand the consequences of what's at stake in this election. Perhaps another Supreme Court seat or two in the next president's term. Whether or not they will try to undo the tremendous progress that President Obama and Vice President Biden have created in the course of their tenure. So,
yeah, of course, Hillary says that too. What about African Americans? Do you have to change the profile of turnout and vote among the African American community in this country to have a prayer?
Absolutely. The African-American constituency is one of the most important core constituencies of the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders, I believe, will be able to appeal to African-Americans across this country as they get to know him. I know sometimes people say, well, you've been out there for months and months and months, and why don't you have anyone to support yet? Well, it's a big country, and it's going to take a long time. But I think if we can be successful, and he has the opportunity to deliver an acceptance speech at the convention, if he has an opportunity to campaign through the country in the fall, his message will resonate powerfully with that community, and I think we will win a lot of support. And I'm sure we'll be helped in that effort by people like President Obama.
Ted, we got 10 seconds with you. How big a Hail Mary is this superdelegate play that you're now counting on?
Well, I think if we win the way I believe we can win between now and California, I don't think it's a Hail Mary at all. I think people will realize it's the right thing to do, and they'll do it.
Ted Devine, top strategist for the Bernie Sanders campaign. Congratulations on last night in Michigan. Joining us today from Miami, Florida. Ted, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, when we come back, we're looking at the big new deal on refugees taking place in Europe and Turkey, playing a dangerous game right in the middle of all that. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. A big deal in the making this week to stop the flood of refugees that has been coming over the water into Greece and Europe. A deal with Turkey. But Turkey is not looking so great lately. The once model Muslim democracy now going heavily authoritarian, a kind of democratically elected dictatorship, playing a new kind of hardball with its own press, its people, its allies, Russia. We're going to look at the new deal emerging on refugees and what is going on with Turkey in the rest of this hour. You can join us. Turks, what is happening with your country? Has a once stable American ally decided to add to the upheaval across the Middle East? In a moment, we'll get views from Washington and London. But today and this week, big news of borders closing around Europe and of a new deal with Turkey that many are hoping will stop the helter-skelter movement of many, many thousands, nearly a million in total, into Europe that we've seen since last summer. Yesterday, here was British Prime Minister David Cameron. He was in Brussels for all the conversation going on there, saying that a draft agreement struck with Turkey could stop human smuggling in the Mediterranean.
The possibility that in future all migrants who arrive in Greece will be returned to Turkey. Now, that would, if implemented, break the business model of the people smugglers and end the link between getting in a boat and getting settlement in Europe.
If they come by water, they are now, if this deal goes through, going to be turned back, headed back, sent back to Turkey. The EU President Donald Tusk was firmer yesterday about the impact of the new agreement that it would have on migrants headed for Europe.
The irregular flow of migrants along the Western Balkan route have now come to an end.
But Turkey has asked a heavy price for this cooperation, and at a time when many are really worried about the politics in Turkey, what they're asking for, what they're getting, the kind of values that they're demonstrating or not demonstrating, and the price of all this. This was Nigel Farage, head of the British right-wing populist UK Independence Party. Okay, was speaking today at the European Parliament in Strasbourg, telling Euro MPs what he thinks of this draft deal, big deal, on refugees with Turkey.
We're embarked upon a course of almost unbelievable stupidity. And now we're being blackmailed by Turkey. They've got us over a barrel.
Blackmailed by Turkey. I want to go first today to Turkey, Istanbul, and Emre Peker, Turkey correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Emre, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What is at the heart of this new deal being struck between the EU, between Europe and Turkey over refugees?
There are three main points to the deal that are critical. The first one is a one-to-one refugee swap, which means that for every migrant or refugee that has illegally arrived on Europe, that is returned to Turkey, EU nations are agreeing to receive one refugee that is housed in a camp here. Essentially, this goes to the heart of what Cameron, as you just played, was also addressing, which is killing the smuggling business. The idea is, if the refugees have a notion that they're going to risk their lives to try and make a deadly crossing across the Aegean and reach Greece, only to be sent right back, and someone else who's in a refugee camp in southeast Turkey will, in their stead, be shipped off to Europe to a nation that agrees to take them, will end the smuggling business.
So one-to-one sounds like no real net difference in the flow, but it's closing off that unregulated sort of wild numbers coming across the Aegean. That's the big deal here. Does Europe think they can use this agreement to actually also turn down the volume of refugees coming in? Is this a way really of turning off the spigot?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the main idea, because everything else that Turkish authorities and EU authorities have tried has so far failed to work. I mean, over the winter months, which is supposed to be a dead season for, illegal crossings because of choppy waters, adverse weather conditions, etc., we've seen numbers surge compared to last year. In the just over 2 months, from the 1st of January until early this week, more than 130,000 people have arrived in Greece via Turkey.
Wow.
So,
That's amazing, and that's before the summer even comes.
That's before the summer comes, and that compares with just over 10,000 people in the same period last year. So that gives you an idea of how determined all these migrants or refugees are to get to Europe. And it's a very raggedy, long coast on both the Greek and Turkish end.
Yep.
It's very easy to hopscotch from the Turkish shore to a Greek island. Even with now a NATO deployment and mission in the Aegean, it's going to be hard to get each and every one of them. So
human rights people are really upset about this. We've got Doctors Without Borders saying this is a clear example of European cynicism. Angela Merkel facing elections this weekend. She wanted to have something in the works apparently before that. Some Germans anyway, maybe getting tired of such an open border here. And also, there's a lot of consternation, as you well know, Emre, because Turkey has bargained for a very high price for its cooperation here. What's it asking for? What's it likely to get?
Yeah, so Tom, you bring me to my second point, which is the financial aid. Back in November, Turkey and the EU had agreed to a 3 billion euro package. This time, Turkey went back and asked the EU to double that amount, essentially.
Wow.
It is uncertain whether Turkey will get all that 6 billion. We have more talks coming up next week on the 17th and the 18th at the European Council meeting. The final figure will be determined there. But it looks like Turkey will definitely get a boost in financial aid, too. Which people always think about this as like a lottery winning or one big fat check, which is not the case. This money will be doled out on a project basis, and released as the two parties agree on what projects to deploy the cash in.
So that's a lot of money. Maybe certainly more than $5 billion. But it's a lot of money. But it's more than money. I mean, Turkey has, of course, they're in NATO, but they've wanted into the EU for a long, long time. With this deal, they're going to be for the first time permitted visa-free travel into Europe for Turks. That's a big deal. Yep. But also, they're saying they want to be brought into the EU. They want a session. I've got a little tape here, Emra, of the Prime Minister in Brussels yesterday after his meeting with EU officials, making pretty clear that if Turkey helps Europe stem this flow of refugees that's driving Europe crazy right now, comes with a big price tag, Turkey's entry or accession into the European Union.
It is important for us to see this as a package of Turkish EU accession process as well. This is a humanitarian process helping refugees, but at the same time, it is a strategic issue for us as Turkey that Turkey will be integrated to EU.
Emre Peker is Turkey correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Emre, please explain to us why this push is so controversial right now. Turkey has turned sharply authoritarian in recent years. They've been raiding newspapers, shutting them down, the biggest circulation paper in the country, with tear gas and everything else going off last week. This is hardly the moment when Turkey is exemplifying the kind of values the EU wants to stand for. But you tell us, why is this so controversial right now?
Look, I mean, Turkey's EU accession talks, which got going in 2005, have been stalled for a very long time now, many, many years. Mm-hmm. And there have been multiple attempts to try and breathe new life into the process and bring Turkey back into the Western fold. The sort of pivot in Turkey only started through last year with the advent of the refugee crisis and also as the situation with the Syrian conflict got out of hand, culminating in Russia's inclusion on the war theater and Turkey's late November shootdown of a Russian jet for violating its airspace from Syria. So Turkey finds itself increasingly isolated in a very violent region that's in turmoil, and it's increasingly turning to its allies in NATO, in the U.S., and in Brussels to try and make up for its shortcomings, be it military or political or diplomatic or economic.
But this is happening at a time when, I mean, I'm looking at a fresh headline here out of Bloomberg View saying Europe should not ignore Turkey's contempt for democracy. What's going on with Turkish democracy? We heard about this big newspaper, sure, Zaman, raided and closed last week with tear gas and everything else flying there. Take us through what's going on with the democratic tradition of Turkey.
So, and at the heart of the domestic issue is a push by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to change Turkey's system of governance to a more US-like or French-like presidential system from its current UK-like parliamentary system.
Shutting down newspapers does not sound like an American system.
Right. So the Zaman takeover is a symptom in a broader problem that we're having. It seems like a lot of people talk about press freedom when it comes to Zaman, but there's also a broader political struggle behind the state authority's seizure of the newspaper.
Okay.
There's a U.S.-based Turkish cleric, Fethullah Gülen, who used to be one of President Erdogan's biggest allies in the first decade that he spent in power as prime minister. But the two allies have had a big falling out that became very public in 2013. And ever since then, Erdogan has accused Gülen and his religious network of plotting a coup to topple his government. So under that excuse, Turkish authorities have gone after big businesses. They jailed the top executives of Turkey's seventh largest conglomerate last week. They've gone after newspapers. Zaman is the second big media company that Turkish authorities are seizing. The other one was seized right before the November elections. And there's this sort of seemingly indiscriminate crackdown against this Gülenist network, which is causing a lot of consternation on the side of the EU, which is very much seen as sort of doing a deal with the devil to stem its own problems. But unfortunately, it doesn't look like this crackdown will go away anytime soon. And if you ask the government, they will tell you, you know, this is not about free press. This is about fighting an organization that has been setting up a rogue network inside state institutions to try and undermine the elected official government and president. But the critics also say, or meanwhile say, that the government is using this crackdown against the Gulenist network to essentially, ride roughshod over all dissent, be it secularists or nationalists or Kurds or, you know, any other ordinary Turks.
We're talking about the big new deal over refugees in Europe, the crisis there, the Europe cutting a deal with Turkey. Controversial because Turkey has been on a big crackdown jag lately. Emre Peker is in Istanbul. We've got callers for you. Amin is calling from Washington, D.C. Amin, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
That night, Turkey's largest media group were taken over by Erdogan, which is not only Zaman, also, I mean, Zaman Daily, Today's Zaman, Axios Magazine, and Cihan News Agency, which is... Those are the largest media group, and actually, this is how he became Turkey's biggest media mogul, Erdogan.
This is just five days ago. Water cannon, tear gas, the works at the front gates. Protesters trying to stop the police there, but in they came.
Yeah, I mean, having executive presidency goals for the near future, Erdogan wants to block all the ways to the opposition and silence every single critical voice.
Amin, are you That's Turkish, fine. And what do you think is going on in your country?
I'm Turkish, and to be honest, like in this position, I don't want to turn back to Turkey because it's like, I mean, I'm feeling like a Hitler's Germany. I mean, he just like cut the voices against him, whoever it is, and they are putting in the jail, especially the journalists. Maybe, you know, like, I mean, more than 30 journalists in the jails right now, and without any criminal
yeah, without criminal charges. Yeah, I mean, you know, I've got more callers here. And this happening at the same time Europe is cutting deals that may speed Turkey's entrance into the EU. Of course, this is a big ally of the United States as well. And there's some dark stuff going on. I want to get another caller right here from New York City. Sitki Özcan is calling. Sitki, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
My little screen tells me you are the U.S. bureau chief of the newspaper Zaman Today. This is one of those that's just been closed. What's going on?
Yes, it's scary things are going on in Turkey. The seasonal far newspaper is not the first blow against press freedom in the country, and most probably will not be the last one. What I wanted to tell is about what Emre has just said about the presidential aims of the already president Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and the takeover of Zaman Daily is important. Yeah, it's our flagship with around 1 million daily circulations, but we also had a news agency which is called Cihan, and it's maybe in terms of timing, the seizure of Cihan is maybe more important than Zaman, because for many years, Cihan has played a role, a significant role for Turkish democracy, as playing the role of election watchdog with around 70,000 volunteers. Cihan had most accurately watched the elections and informed the public.
Sitki, let me ask you, we just have a minute before the break. You just had big elections in Turkey last year, so Erdogan might well say, look, we're doing elections. What do you want? This is democracy. Is Turkish democracy healthy today, Sitki?
Absolutely not. If now, when you look at the media structure in the country, more than 60-70% of the media that is supposed to inform the people about the elections and give voice to other parties and et cetera, 60-70% of the media is directly controlled by the family. Erdogan's son-in-law owns most of these media organizations, and the rest is either provided by huge government tenders to buy their silence, or intimidated by huge tax fines in Acerba. Now, all Turkish people follow the news about the takeover of our paper from international media outlets. You can't see most of the stories in Turkish media.
And this is the country with which the EU now doing this big, big deal on refugees. Sitki Özcan, U.S. Bureau Chief for one of the papers just closed a handful of days ago. Thank you for calling in today. It's great to have you here. Emre Peker in Istanbul, Turkey correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. We've got more turf to cover, but we're very grateful to you, Emre, for setting us up. Thanks for all your coverage out of Turkey, Emre.
Sure thing.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. And enter offer code ONPOINT at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Europe's big new refugee deal with an increasingly authoritarian Turkey. Turkey driving a hard bargain with Europe as it, in many fronts, appears to be rejecting European political values, cracks down on dissent and its own people. This as a big deal being done just in this handful of days to be confirmed at a bigger summit next week. You can join us this hour. Turks, what is happening in your country? What's happening to your once admired Muslim democracy? And has Turkey become another dictatorship of some kind in the Middle East? Turkish democracy supporters, what's going on? What do you need there? Just a few days ago, last Friday, Turkish protesters, here's the sound. They're being bombarded with tear gas, rubber bullets outside the offices of Zaman newspaper in Istanbul. It was taken over in a police raid. That is not the sound of a free press. And inside, the one of the editors there recorded the sound of her colleagues watching the police come in chanting, "Free media cannot be silenced." Are you feeling that? But it can be silenced. It has essentially been silenced right there. During that raid, here was editor of the Today's Zaman English edition tweeting out a video describing the government takeover.
"The police attacked me physically. The police grabbed my cell phone from my hand while I was doing Periscope. The police did not allow me in our own newspaper building."
With me right now from Washington is Umer Tashpinar. He is professor of national security strategy at the National Defense University in Washington, non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He was a contributor to Today's Zaman, one of the papers just closed by the Turkish authorities, author of Winning Turkey, How the U.S. and Europe Can Revive a Fading Partnership. Umer, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So we've got this huge deal on refugees, Europe desperately scrambling to shut off this helter-skelter flood across the Aegean. But who are they making this deal with? What is going on with Turkish politics, Umer?
Well, Europe is making this deal with the only person that they can make the deal with, who is the President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. We have a very strong personalization of power right now in the country. Erdogan is the president, although the system of Turkey is a parliamentary system, the prime minister is supposedly in charge, yet Erdogan is controlling all the institutions, including the prime minister. And he was elected by the people as the president of the country, yet the constitution says that he has to be impartial. He should not have a political role, yet he's defying the Turkish constitution. He's obviously a very political president, and he wants to change the constitution and change the system in Turkey, as Emre Peker mentioned, into a presidential system. The problem in Turkey is that he's elected, and the party that he's representing and the prime minister is representing, the Justice and Development Party, is still very popular in the eyes of around 50% of the people. And the opposition in Turkey, unfortunately, is not very popular. It lacks a charismatic leadership, and the economy overall is doing well in Turkey compared to other emerging markets, despite a slowdown in the growth rate. People look at their life and you arguably have a better life compared to 10 years ago. They have jobs. The infrastructure of the country is better. The services are better. And in many ways, when people look at the news, they see Erdogan on their TV. And when they go to the ballot box, in the absence of a better alternative, they keep voting for this very autocratic populist president.
So if they keep doing that, maybe Europe is right to not to hesitate on that front. Maybe we should just pipe down. This is Turkish democracy. This is what Turks want. And yet we hear that takeover of the newspaper. It just sounds like the antithesis of a free, open society.
Well, here's the dilemma. Elections are free in Turkey. People go to the ballot box and vote for the political party that they want, and they're not rigged. Overall, European institutions, American institutions, when they monitor Turkish elections, they accept that those are free elections. Yet the problem is that they're not very fair, these elections. So they're not really fair. They're free but not fair.
Wow, why?
Because elections, in order to be fair, people have to have access to independent media.
Yeah, true.
They need to have access to the voice of opposition, to dissenting voices. There has to be basically campaigns and maybe debates on TV between the president and the opposition. Those are absolutely absent in Turkish democracy. Opposition papers, the so-called opposition papers, there are still a few of them active. Zaman was one of the biggest opposition papers, but there are a few centrist opposition papers. Well, they're engaged in self-censorship. Their columnists are not really able to criticize the government, and when they do, they're fired. In order to keep their jobs, they're reluctant to criticize. I even sensed in Emre's answer to you about Zaman newspaper that he was a little bit reluctant to criticize the government because he lives in Turkey and he needs to have access to people in power. Even if, despite the fact that he works for the Wall Street Journal, I mean, he has to tone down his criticism of the government.
What about Turks who are not journalists? Do individual Turks feel intimidated? Do they feel free to express dissatisfaction with the Erdogan government or not?
The politicized Turks, those who are active on social media, Twitter, they are intimidated because there are about 1,500 or 2,000 lawsuits against people who have supposedly insulted the president on social media.
That's literally a criminal charge in Turkey.
It is a criminal charge. So freedom of speech is problematic in Turkey. Freedom of association, freedom of the media, the independence of the judiciary, all these elements that make democracies function are either missing or at their infancy in Turkey right now. This is why it's, I think, wrong to call Turkey a dictatorship, but it's more of an illiberal democracy where checks and balances over the executive power are missing.
Umar Tashpiner, please stand by in Washington. Right now from London, John Peet joins us. He's political editor at The Economist, was formerly with the British Foreign Office, co-author of Unhappy Union, How the Euro Crisis and Europe Can Be Fixed. John Peet, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi.
So here we are. We see Europe doing a big deal on refugees with Turkey saying we want entry to the EU to be very much part of this deal in one way or another, even if just in a momentum way. And from afar, it doesn't look good, John. It looks as though Europe's throwing its arms around Turkey at the very moment when it's become, as Umar says, an illiberal democracy, an autocracy. Is there real hesitation in Europe, or they're just so desperate to solve the refugee problem they don't care right now?
I think you're absolutely right on it. They are desperate to solve the refugee problem, which is destabilizing Angela Merkel in Germany and causing ructions all around the EU. And many people inside the EU are saying, you know, this is the worst crisis the EU has ever had. It's worse even than the euro crisis. Clear just from its position that Turkey has to play a critical role in helping to solve the refugee crisis, because a lot of these refugees are coming via Turkey from Syria, from Afghanistan. So you have to work with the Turks. And yes, in a situation like the present one, you have to work with the Turks, even if you're worried that Turkey is moving in, even if you're worried that Erdogan has become increasingly dictatorial in opposition. You know, he once said that it was like a train, and when you got to your destination, should get off your train. All those things have been around for a long time. But I think rather in the way that, you know, you Americans had to work with Putin over Syria, you can't always choose who you do deals with.
But we're not making Putin part of the United States. We're not trying to bring Russia into, and you're trying to maybe open the way for Turkey to join the EU.
I think you need to be quite careful about what you're predicting Emery was saying, mm-hmm. this has been around from we first started to talk to Turkey back in 2005. So it's been a
John, I apologize, but your line is breaking up very badly here, and I will try and get you back in a better line. Umer, it's true that these conversations have gone on for a long time and pretty fruitlessly, but we heard earlier in the hour, Europeans now saying Turkey is using this leverage, ultimate crisis faced or engendered by the refugee inflow, and asking for the sort of maximal deal here. Could Turkey, at the same moment it's turning into an autocracy, as you say, negotiate its way into the EU?
Look, the EU negotiations, membership to the European Union, is a very long process.
Yep.
It takes 36 different chapters, from environmental law to human rights to infrastructure, to be negotiated. And it requires the harmonization of the Turkish legal system with the European legal system. So it's not like Turkey can sneak in a couple months to the European Union. The Turks basically want, I think the Turkish government wants, a fair deal. They want basically a normal negotiation. They want countries like France and Germany to drop their opposition to Turkish membership, because in the past, Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president, and Angela Merkel mm-hmm. have argued that Turkey should not become a member of the EU and that there should be a privileged partnership instead of full membership. So Turkey basically is saying, no, we should continue negotiations and there should be a rapid reconsideration of all these chapters. But my estimate is that, in the most positive estimate, I think it will take at least 4 or 5 years for Turkey to become a member. And there will be conditions. I think along the way, the EU will put conditions ranging from recognition of the Republic of Cyprus to improvements in Turkey's Kurdish question, maybe the recognition of the Armenian genocide. All these things will come to the table. So it's not like Turkey can become a member of the European Union overnight in its current state.
What about the health of its democracy? You hear a lot of Turks saying Erdogan is concentrating power in a way that's out of line with the Turkey's own tradition. Do you think Europe has enough leverage, given their fear of the refugee flow, to really change the direction or maybe the anti-democratic drift?
Well, Europe will gain some leverage. I think it's important for Turkey to feel that there is light at the end of the tunnel in terms of EU membership, because in the past, many Turks, including liberal secular Turks like myself, have lost hope about EU membership in the sense that yep. we thought the EU would always say no to Turkey. Now, if you can re-energize Turkey-EU negotiations, maybe this will provide an incentive to Turkey mm-hmm. to move in the right direction. Oh. Right now, Turkey looks very ugly. I admit that. But this is not the Turkey that will become a member of the European Union one day.
I'm going to get back to John Peet in just a second. A call first from Hakan in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hakan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have voted for Erdogan in 2007, and I was extremely hopeful and like proud for the things that he made for our democracy, giving back the rights for the different religious and ethnic minorities like the Armenian people and the Kurdish people.
Yeah.
Something happened, and this long-term power that he holds like makes things corrupted for everything. And now he has zero tolerance for any criticism that the government does. And you believe me, you can't do this kind of radio program or discussion in the current Turkey.
We couldn't be having this show on the air in Turkey, and you voted for Erdogan. Something happened. Let us look at what that might be. John, calling from Boston. John, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I think to make it easier to understand for the American listeners, all they have to do is just watch House of Cards. So this is the state of democracy in Turkey now.
Are you Turkish, John?
I'm Turkish.
Okay.
I've been in the U.S. for the last 23 years.
Okay.
And I think, you know, the Turkish democracy has been also described as a zombie democracy by the Economist. Right now, the mentality is the majority rules with an iron fist. And this goes against everything that we know that will stimulate the economy. So I'm a professor of economics. So I would like to put some caution also on the economic prospects of Turkey.
You're worried about them with the current political dynamics there. John, our time is short, and I want to get back to John Peet in London. John Peet, I hope we got a better line. Are you confident that this deal will go through next week? 6 billion euros and the other promises that Turkey's asking for, visa-free travel for Turks to the EU, and maybe an open path toward EU membership.
Well, I think the 6 billion euros will probably go through. I mean, Turkey has taken a lot of refugees, so it's not unreasonable for the EU to help them.
Mm-hmm.
I think, yes, probably progress towards visa-free travel. I think that one may be more controversial, but I think we'll see some progress towards it. It was already being talked about extensively. But when it comes to EU membership, as several contributors have been saying, that is a very, very long way off.
Yep.
And I actually think that for a long time there has been a case for saying to the Turks, look, it will take a long time, but we would like to keep negotiating with you, because the EU has experience in this area of talking to countries that have been not very democratic, not very liberal. Slovakia was a great example in the 1990s. And they said to the Slovaks, if you don't change, you're not going to be let in. And the Slovaks then did change, and they became more democratic.
But the Slovaks did not have the leverage over Europe that Turkey has right now with this tremendous fire hose of refugees.
That's absolutely right. But we're talking about a process that will take at least 10 years, probably longer, before anybody anywhere could think of letting Turkey into the European Union. And during that time, I think the European Union can continue to say to the Turks that if you keep behaving as you do now, you're just not going to get in. The people of Europe won't let you in. There will be referendums in France, maybe in Austria, which will not approve Turkish membership. So Turkey will be told, and Erdogan will be told, that if he seriously wants to get into the EU, he's going to have to change his behavior. And I think that process can have a beneficial effect on the way Turkey is moving.
We'll see.
And I think also the economy of Turkey is not looking as good as people were saying. And I agree with your last caller that in the absence of more liberalization within Turkey, they're going to have some economic problems facing them as well.
Umar, we've just got half a minute here. It's way too little. But on the front of ISIS and Russia and Syria, Turkey's critical with all of this political tension. Is it an effective ally of the U.S. and Europe on this front right now or not?
Well, that brings us to the question of democracy again, because the most important challenge facing Turkey now is the Kurdish question, which has a clear Syrian angle now. Turkey is fighting a Kurdish insurgency in the southeast, and it's the PKK, and the U.S. basically is helping the PKK in Syria. It's the same organization. So Turkey is in a very difficult position in terms of its relations with the United States, and the only solution is a dialogue with the Kurds, a peace process with the Kurds, which requires democratization in Turkey, which is absent right now.
A big knot here, a big tangle between refugee crisis, the politics of Turkey, the open warfare we've got in Syria and beyond ISIS and all the rest flowing through Turkey. We've learned a lot in this hour. We're going to have to come back to the Turkish question. Umar Tashpinar at the National Defense University in Washington, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
John Peet at The Economist in London. Mr. Peet, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thank you for joining us. This is On Point.